516209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Past and the Internet by Jeffrey Bowker, Regis and Diane McKenna, Chair and Executive Director, Center for Science, Technology, and Society, Santa Clara University, on Thursday, February 28th at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of fair trade Oriental rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Tuesday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informal seminar about Oriental rugs will be held at the store. For more information, call 352-8200.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll spend some time thinking about and talking about the whole project that has come to be called multiculturalism and trying to ask some very basic questions about what it is we're trying to do and what it is we're hoping to achieve. For example, what is black culture? Is there such a thing? Does it have a unique essence? And does it deserve legal protection? It's not something that simply applies to African Americans. You could fill in that blank and put in whatever kind of culture you like, because people around the world do talk in those kinds of terms about themselves and their culture. Our guest this morning is Stanford Law Professor Richard Ford. He has written about this subject in his book, Racial Culture, A Critique, which takes a look at this whole idea of multiculturalism. And in fact, he makes the argument that the defense of cultural practices of social groups may ultimately not benefit the members of those groups very much. In fact, he says that this kind of fixation on difference might actually get in the way of making progress toward a society that truly values diversity. The contributions and thoughts and comments of people who are listening are certainly welcome. If you'd like to pick up the telephone and give us a call, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So definitely, people who are listening are welcome into the conversation. The book, by the way, Racial Culture, is published by the Princeton University Press and should be available in bookstores if you would like to read it. Professor Ford, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I understand. You're a little under the weather, so I appreciate you doing it, even though you might not be feeling tip-top. I guess that in taking a look at the book, a couple of things caught my attention right away, right up front. And that is in your preface, where you're talking about how it is you came even to be thinking about this subject. First of all, in here you said that actually you for some time had been a little reluctant to say the things that you ultimately say in the book.
Yes.
And your comment here right up front is that you'd give a talk based on some of the progress you'd made toward what this book ended up being, and someone in the audience, in which you had titled Racial Culture is a Reluctant Critique of Identity Politics. And apparently somebody who had listened to you had said, why call it reluctant? You don't sound reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go on to say that, in fact, you had been a little reluctant to make the arguments and talk about the things in the book that you do. And perhaps that as a way of easing people who don't think about these things at all, if a little bit or not at all, I could ask you to talk a little bit about that. What was the root of your reluctance?
Well, I guess there were a couple roots of my reluctance. One, I expected the reception of the arguments that I'm making in the book to be not entirely welcoming from some communities, and communities that I care about and communities that I consider myself to be a part of. I expected that some African Americans and race-conscious progressives wouldn't like the arguments much. So there was some concern about that. But more substantively, I was concerned that the arguments people make in favor of legal rights for cultural difference are made with very good intentions. And they would, in fact, help some people with legitimate grievances to pursue their claims in court. So arguing against the arguments, in some sense, I was reluctant to make a critique of these arguments for those reasons. But ultimately, I came to the conclusion that the broader social effect of these claims was counterproductive to the cause of anti-racism and to the cause of cultural harmony. So I went ahead and made the critiques, and I suppose over time I did become less reluctant to make them as I continued my work and became more convinced of my arguments.
Well, and I guess the other thing that right away caught my attention is the idea here, the big question that's embedded in this whole project here, that you really begin by asking a question something like this. For someone who identifies themselves as being politically on the left, someone who would say, I am opposed to racism, for that kind of person to ask the question, well, what possibly could be wrong with the idea of multiculturalism? And I guess that interested me a lot, that you would ask that very question and that we would approach it from that direction, because most of the critique of multiculturalism comes from the right. It doesn't come from the left. And,
right.
And on the left, it's sort of an unquestioned kind of idea. And it does indeed seem on the face of it to be something that's certainly positive. It's sort of difficult to find what might possibly be wrong with it. What is from the perspective of the person that you are, someone who is someone who identifies with the left side of the political spectrum, generally speaking, and would say, well, certainly, of course, I'm opposed to racism. Well, what is wrong with multiculturalism?
Well, it's a couple of things. I'm concerned, my primary concern is about the collapse of issues of racism with issues of cultural difference. And I think that move, that collapse, is central to much of the multiculturalist conversation that has been going on over the past 20 or so years. So it's just assumed that either that problems of racism are in fact problems in cultural difference, so that when someone discriminates on the basis of race, they're somehow doing it because of a cultural difference, because of cultural misunderstanding, because of intolerance of a person's distinctive culture. And then, in addition, that therefore problems of racism are analogous to problems of cultural difference. So you get quotes like quotes that collapse, for instance, in the preface of the or in the preamble of the book. I have one: the American Black, the American Indian, the Canadian Inuit, the New England Maori, the Australian Aborigine, the Basque in Spain, the French Canadians in Canada, and the Tamils in Sri Lanka. That strikes me that a statement that sweeps all of these groups with their disparate problems, through disparate circumstances together, and presumes that they're all suffering from an identical form of social oppression, is probably mistaken. And so just as an analytical matter, we make a mistake by collapsing race and culture. It strikes me that the issues of racism, which I see primarily having to do with atavistic prejudice, are distinct from those of cultural difference, which do, in fact, have to do with misunderstandings, clashes of divergent norms, and divergent practices.
Hmm. I guess one of the questions I have in my mind, though, is it really, in some cases, it would be easy to separate ethnicity and culture. But in other cases, it seems that, if we're talking about an issue of discrimination, to identify what really the issue is. In some cases, it would seem to be pretty easy. In other cases, I guess I'm not so sure that it's going to be all that clear. Yeah.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, I think you're right about that. And that, I mean, one of the impetuses for this sort of multiculturalist move is that in some cases it may be difficult to disentangle the two. But nevertheless, I think we can, first of all, we can disentangle the two as a conceptual matter. We can think of a variety of forms of racial discrimination that really have nothing to do with cultural difference. I mean, historically, the classic forms of racial discrimination that have plagued this nation have not had to do with cultural difference. They've simply had to do with atavistic prejudice that was triggered by skin color, by facial features. It was triggered on sight. Had nothing to do with a clash of norms between groups. Now, that paradigmatic form of racism is still alive and well. And it's important, I think, to identify that and to distinguish that from the types of clashes that that go on as a result of cultural difference, which I might add primarily involve different groups. So there's no doubt that we have problems of cultural difference, but they primarily involve clashes between people based on between people of different national origins, relatively recent immigrants. That's the main site of cultural clash in the United States, and it's a real problem. It's a real issue that needs to be addressed. It's not obvious to me that it needs to be addressed in the same way that we address anti-racism. Now, to work back around to your question, aren't there some circumstances in which it's hard to disentangle the two? Yes, there are. But it strikes me that we still need to make the effort. And courts, in dealing with anti-discrimination law, have traditionally made the effort, and I think have been able to do a reasonably good job. I think in some cases they could do a better job, but I don't think the answer is to abandon the effort to make the distinction. And if we do abandon the effort to make the distinction, I think we run into several fairly serious problems will make anti-discrimination law ultimately difficult to administer and problematic normatively.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Richard Ford, Richard T. Ford. He's the George Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford Law School and has published in many legal journals. He has certainly written about issues of race and racial discrimination. He's also the author of a recently published book titled Racial Culture, A Critique, and it is published by the Princeton University Press, that explores these ideas that here we've been talking about, ideas of multiculturalism, identity politics, looking at this question, does culture deserve the same kind of protection? Are we as concerned, should we be as concerned about discrimination on cultural grounds as we are discrimination on racial grounds? And he says he's not so sure about that. And in fact, that a particular kind of multiculturalism is, you know, maybe not only is it not positive for the groups we're trying to protect, it may indeed be negative. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Some, I think that maybe some people might be scratching their heads a little bit over the term multiculturalism.
Yes, or
they think about it, sort of in the grade school sense, you know, where every week we have a festival to honor the different group, and we, you know, we have their food, and we make cardboard cutouts, and we wear their clothing, and you know, we tell some story about some little girl who comes from the, I know I'm intentionally being sort of flip and irreverent, but sometimes that seems to be our approach to multiculturalism, and says, well, isn't it everybody's okay, everybody's nice, everybody has their own culture, and they're all good, and we'll learn a little bit about it, and we'll all get along better. I'm not sure exactly that's really what it is we're talking about in the more serious sense. What really is it? I mean, when you talk about multiculturalism, and particularly the kind that you're sort of concerned about, what really is it that we're talking about?
Oh, good. That's a great question. I mean, obviously, multiculturalism refers to a lot of different things, and I'm not critiquing all of the variants of multiculturalism. I suppose the version I'm most concerned about is one that presumes that a particular racial or ethnic group whose membership is basically based on ancestry corresponds to a particular set of cultural practices, so that anybody who's a member of the racial or ethnic group is presumed also to have adopted a specific set of cultural practices that we could identify. So, to take the example of African Americans, so that anyone who's African American embodies lives out black culture. And black culture could be reduced to a list of attributes that we, you know, that everyone knows about. So we all know what black culture is, and it's the same across black people throughout the United States. That's the version of multiculturalism that worries me. Now, I've deliberately oversimplified it a bit, but I think, you know, this argument or this conception probably should sound familiar to most of your listeners. It's that idea that worries me, because I think that, in fact, cultural practices among members of a racial group, again, I'll take African Americans as an example, are quite varied. They vary by region, they vary by age, they vary by socioeconomic class. So that to talk about black culture as sort of a unified thing is problematic. And maybe the larger problem with this this idea of multiculturalism is that it tends to be prescriptive. It tends to push members of the group in question into what I think it's fair to say are stereotypical types of behavior. So, and I think we see this on college campuses quite a bit, that for an African American student to be considered authentic, to be considered you know, a real African American and not an Oreo, for instance, they are expected to exhibit certain types of behavior, certain modes of speech, certain types of dress that are kind of stereotypically understood to be associated with African-American culture. And it may well not be, and I think in many cases isn't, increasingly isn't, the sort of natural way in which these students would behave. They come to behave that way in some cases because of a narrative, because of a script that's told about their identity. So in that sense, I think it's the multiculturalist ideas can become a source of regulation of individuals that's unfortunate. And it's actually restricts real diversity.
Yeah, well, that I guess that really gets at one of the larger ideas that I think you deal with and is certainly worth thinking about, and that is, to put it in very simple terms, while on the one hand we think about multiculturalism as a force that brings people together, the downside is that, in fact, it may do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you see? You really do see happening, and perhaps in a larger, yes, and indeed we've seen that on college campuses.
Yes,
but even in the larger world,
To some extent, I think yes. The concern there, so that's a slightly different concern, but only slightly. The worry would be that the multiculturalist story that's being told is one that presumes that the various racial groups and ethnic groups that make up our society are also defined by distinctive practices, distinctive aesthetic norms, and distinctive, maybe even ethical norms, that divide them from other groups. So that one of the typical types of multiculturalist claims, when there's a clash over values or there's a social clash of some kind, is we're entitled to our practices because they're our culture, and you, as an outsider, can't possibly understand, so you have no right to comment or to judge our practices. Now, one outcome of this argument, this narrative, is that it's presumed then that we can't have dialogue across groups. That on important issues in which groups may well clash, there's no common ground. There's no ability to have a conversation across groups. And in fact, it tends to lead, I think, in many instances, to segregation. Yes, you may have your own norms, but since they're incompatible with our norms, we need you to have them over there, and we'll have ours over here. And that strikes me as unfortunate, too, and especially in a context in which I believe the divergence in norms and values and ethics among racial groups in the United States is very slight, if perhaps even non-existent. That in fact Americans share values and norms and ethics to a very large degree, and that there's a great deal of possibility for conversation across groups. The real clashes have to do, again, with matters of the distribution of wealth, They have to do with questions of atavistic social prejudice, you know, which still exists, but at the same time, about which there's fairly broad social consensus that it should be eliminated. So I think there is a more possibility for conversation among groups and for integrated environments of a variety of kinds than multiculturalism in this mode that I described allows for.
Well, there. Let me just say, we have a question here from a caller. I want to get to them, but let me just go ask sort of one further question here. That there, I think that probably we could find examples around the world where we would agree there was indeed discrimination based on cultural difference.
I agree,
but that you is it that you are saying here? You think that in the United States, generally speaking, now you know maybe indeed we could. If we looked hard enough, we could find it, but that it wouldn't be all that easy to find, and that chances are we probably would not find that among African Americans.
I don't want to quite say that. What I would like to say is that I think the instances of cultural discrimination are distinct from instances of racial discrimination. That's the main point I'd like to make, and I think that it's possible, and that in fact many times multiculturalist discourse has exaggerated the extent to which the society is plagued by cultural differences and clashes that are based on real cultural differences, as opposed to both racial discrimination, atavistic prejudice on the one hand, but also as opposed to just disagreements, ideological disagreements. And so that's another mistake that could be made, that we tend to describe an ideological disagreement as a disagreement based on culture, which sort of takes it outside the realm of normal politics, normal dialogue. We have mechanisms in society to deal with clashes of norms. That's what liberal democracies are designed to do. Most questions, most ideological clashes should be dealt with by the normal mechanisms of democratic politics in the market economy. And so it's possible to exaggerate the extent of cultural clashes as opposed to these other these other types of clashes. Now, that's not to say that there are no instances of cultural discrimination, but it does strike me that when we're dealing with questions of cultural difference, we need to have a different type of analysis than that applies to racial difference, because in fact it's very difficult to separate questions of cultural difference from garden variety ideological conflict or garden variety disagreement about aesthetics, the type of things that we think normally should just kind of be fought out in the normal give and take of everyday life.
Okay, well, let's talk with a caller here. We have someone listening in Urbana on our line one right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Just as an aid to myself, could I bring up the question of scientific creationism? I know it's a little oddball, but at one point it was easy for us to recognize that people who were intent on racial discrimination, people who were simply racists, benign or evil racists, took to Darwinian evolution and said, here is a reason why some races are better, should be given preferences over others. Mm-hmm. They took what was a scientific question and used it for their own means. In an analogous way, people who are intent on promoting the notion of creationism would say there's a way of looking at scientific creationism. And by analogy, and I hate to simplify it, but for my own sake I must, are we talking about people who for their own racist reasons will agree to the notion of multiculturalism and skew it in such a way that it reinforces their pre-existing prejudices anyway? That's the question. I mean, you've done a very complex analogy, argument here.
Right.
And I just would like to simplify it to bad people will use any means to do bad things.
Great question. I think that's a concern, most definitely. So multiculturalism can be deployed by, you know, what you've described as just regular old racists in order to reinforce their views. I think there's a lot to that, so that as the idea of biological difference between races has been thrown into disrepute, as the notion that we could understand racial differences, you know, primarily a matter of significant biological differences between people has been discredited. The idea that we can describe racial difference as a function of cultural practices has come to the fore as the new justification for belief in racial difference. And yes, I think it's certainly not only possible, but in fact has happened that that argument has been used by racists to continue to justify their ideology, as well as by well-meaning multiculturalists. So it's a yes, I agree with you. I think it's a risk. Now, that's not the only thing that I'm talking about, because I'm also concerned that people with good motivations and good intentions are sort of inadvertently playing into a narrative that I agree with you. I think, in fact, reinforces racist beliefs.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that is why I bring up the two notions historically and currently. You can have benign racists, good motivation that twists and warps things wrongly, as well as evil racists.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to bring that up to see if I was misunderstanding part of the discussion, and I'm glad to hear what you had to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to join. Questions, comments are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, you could be listening on the Internet as long as you're in the United States. You could use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We are just a little bit past the midpoint here, and again, I should introduce our guest, Richard Ford. He is George Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, and if you're interested in reading in greater depth his ideas on this subject here we're discussing, you should look for his book, Racial Culture, A Critique, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. Have people made the argument that cultural discrimination is something that ought to have a legal remedy, that it ought to actually be addressed in law the way that we address discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity or of sexual orientation?
Yes, they have. In fact, there have been several proposals to do this in a variety of ways. The most common, I think, in the United States or in the American legal literature, and the one that I address in the book, is simply an argument that we should expand the legal prohibition of discrimination on the basis of race to include discrimination on the basis of the cultural practices that go along with race. So, for instance, in the book, I've given several examples where this argument has actually been deployed in various ways in court. In one case, a plaintiff, Renee Rogers, was discharged as a result of she worked at American Airlines, and was discharged as a result of a grooming code, a dress code that prohibited, among other things, her all-braided hairstyle, her cornrow hairstyle. And she sued American Airlines for race and sex discrimination and made the claim that the cornrow hairstyle was part of the cultural essence of black women, and therefore to prohibit the hairstyle was identical, was the same as race discrimination and sex discrimination. Now, she lost that case, but the claim was interesting, and the claim was actually taken up by a lot of legal scholars who thought that the case was wrongly decided, that in fact she should have won on the basis of the claim that the cornrow hairstyle was the cultural essence of black women. Another case involved a plaintiff who brought who worked with a girls' club that was designed to keep sort of impoverished young girls kind of on the straight and narrow on a path to a better life, set up by a civic organization. And one of the rules was that all of the people working there had to be positive role models. And pregnancy out of wedlock violated this role model rule for reasons one can understand. One of the major problems that these girls faced was getting pregnant out of wedlock and then having their life opportunities so restricted by that fact. this plaintiff, in fact, did become pregnant out of wedlock and was discharged under the role model rule. And her argument, which was striking, I think, was that this was race discrimination because of the higher out-of-wedlock pregnancy rates found among black women. That essentially the argument, again, was getting out-of-wedlock pregnancy is part of black culture. Now, I mean, I think in this context, one can see quite clearly the potentially disturbing implications of that argument. If, as the previous caller suggested, an evil racist were to make the argument that out-of-wedlock pregnancy is part of black culture, I think we'd all be appalled, and rightly so. Yet, here a litigant makes exactly that argument in court and asks the federal courts to endorse that argument, to give that argument, that account of black culture, the imprimatur of law. So those are just two examples, but there are actually quite a few in the legal literature of proposals of this sort.
Well, that, I guess, one of the questions that it raises is when you're talking about two things like that, however you feel about the particular examples, what it shows is that those two things, these two elements that someone is arguing is a part of somebody's culture, are wildly different. And I suppose that leads to this question of, you know, how, even if one was going to decide that culture was something that deserved legal protection, then the question would be, who is it that determines what qualifies? How do you, even if you're going to make the argument that we are going to protect culture, then we're going to say, all right, so how do we define culture? What are the items that we're going to say are essential to somebody's culture? Who is going to determine? Are we going to bring all the people together and have them fill out a survey or, you know, have a vote? I mean, how does one even, that seems such a difficult thing to grab hold of.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's one of my concerns that culture, these proposals presume that culture is something, a matter of fact, something that we can just observe in society, and so we'll know when we look at society, this is black culture, these are the elements of it, this qualifies. But of course it's not like that at all, and I think any anthropologist would agree that this question of defining culture, and certainly of distinguishing it, if we were going to try to distinguish it from other types of, let's see, again, ideological conflict, it would have extremely difficult. And the worry I have is that the people who will wind up defining the content of various cultures will get it wrong in the sense that they will identify things that conform to popular stereotypes, and we'll have popular stereotypes reinforced by the federal courts under the guise of anti-discrimination law. So I think it's quite problematic. And I suppose I could say one more thing on this question, because I think it's central to the argument of the book. If we look at this divergence between, on the one hand, cultural rights to a hairstyle, on the other hand, cultural rights to out-of-wedlock pregnancy, it strikes me that it's fairly easy to see that we're dealing with, if we were to protect either of those things through legal rights, if we were to say to an employer, you may not discriminate on the basis of a hairstyle, you may not discriminate on the basis of out-of-wedlock pregnancy, that we're facing quite different policy questions. And just as a matter of sound policy analysis, it's a mistake to collapse them and imagine that they could be answered through a question about the content of racial culture. I think there's a good argument that employers, for instance, have too much authority over employees in terms of their kind of personal modes of dress and grooming. I think it's entirely plausible that we should have law that would prohibit employers from forbidding a variety of hairstyles, or would restrict the ability of the employer to tell their employees how they can dress. That's a plausible argument. I'd certainly be willing to entertain that argument. It seems to me that argument has very little to do with race discrimination. It's a distinct argument. And if one looks at, for instance, the airline industry has historically been quite strict in its dress code, not just attached to hairstyles associated with race, but has had extremely strict dress codes attached in general. Whether or not they should be allowed to do that, I think, is a complicated question. But it's not a question that's usefully answered by reference to race or racial culture. It's a distinct question. And the same is true with questions of pregnancy. I mean, my own view, and it's since become the view of the U.S. Congress as well, is that employers should not be able to discriminate on the basis of pregnancy. But that's not a question that's answered by an argument about race and racial culture. It's a question that's answered by arguments about personal autonomy and privacy and the importance of childbearing in our society. So it's just an analytic mistake to collapse them with issues of race.
And just to, I have a couple of calls here I'll get right to, but just to sort of underline a point that I made in passing earlier about your concerns as you're looking at the subject and you're making the argument of saying, well, maybe we ought to think a little bit about this business of giving culture legal protection. Just let's look where, if you follow this argument out to its logical conclusion, where it is we may end up, and the concern that, in fact, not only might it not be positive, it might be negative, is your bottom line concern, the one here that you've kind of illustrated, at least with one of these examples, is that you're saying, let's be careful about this because we have no idea what sort of negative stereotypes, negative values, anything we might suddenly find that we have given a legal status.
Yes, that is my concern. And then we can add to that the problem that once they've been given legal status, it's all the more likely that they'll become sort of prescriptive for members of the group, that the members of the group will be pushed to adopt those stereotypical behaviors as a, you know, question of their, as a signal of their racial identity, of their authenticity. So it's a vicious cycle.
All right. Well, we have some other folks to talk with, several of them, starting with caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have some problems with your disallowing ethnicity, culture rather, as a form of or a basis of discrimination. And I'm thinking of the Native American cultures where there seems to have been a very systematic attempt to stamp out the culture, particularly Native American religions, but also social forms.
Yes. Well, you're certainly right about the history of Native American oppression. I guess it strikes me that question raises issues that just don't fit easily in our current anti-discrimination legal paradigm. That really, the question of Native American, the treatment of Native Americans in the United States is an enormous question. I think it needs to be addressed really on its own terms as something that's quite distinct. That it's not really a question of I shouldn't say garden variety discrimination, but it's not a question of discrimination of the type that Title VII, for instance, the federal anti-discrimination in employment statute, is designed to address. Because really, in order to really address the issue of Native American culture, one needs to do much more than just prohibit discrimination against certain practices in employment or in housing. One would need to address the entire sort of physical infrastructure that's necessary for these communities to continue their practices. And I think what we've seen is that this is a very, very difficult thing to do in the context of a society that is now quite industrialized. I don't have easy answers to that question, but it does seem to me the idea that we could deal with them through a standard anti-discrimination paradigm can't be right.
Well, it seems to me it goes beyond that, but also includes that.
And also includes with the standard anti-discrimination paradigm?
Yes.
Well, I suppose I would say this. We'll run into exactly the same problems that I've identified in the context of black culture when one tries to do this on a systematic basis. Mm-hmm. We'll have a problem. Now, let me pause for a minute and say that religion is a distinctive issue. And there's, I could say a lot more about religion, but it does require a distinctive analysis. It's always been understood that religion is nothing but a collection of practices. But religion does occupy a quite difficult status in anti-discrimination law for just that reason. Now, when we move past religion and into issues of culture generally, in a context in which people are integrated into the mainstream society, so at this point I'm assuming that the only context in which this would arise would be a context in which Native Americans were generally integrated into mainstream society and faced some form of cultural discrimination in the workplace.
Well, would you consider language as an element of culture?
Language, yes. Language is another question that I think raises distinctive issues. Again, it may well be that in certain contexts we should prohibit employers from discriminating on the use of language, but it does seem to me to raise issues that are distinct from those traditionally associated with anti-discrimination law. I mean, most obviously, language is a mode of communication, and employers will many times have very good reasons to require their employees to speak in a language that most people can understand. That's just an obvious example, but there are others in which language is going to raise distinct issues. So I would find it difficult to endorse a rule that said that the employer could never have language-related rules. And that's essentially what the proposal would be if we were going to say language is an attribute of racial or national origin discrimination.
Well, let's have a context in which two workers are standing next to one another. Both are Mexican-American. Both feel more comfortable conversing in Spanish.
Right.
They're not talking to anyone else in the group.
Mm-hmm.
Should they be prohibited from speaking in Spanish?
Should they be prohibited? There's actually a case that deals with this exact question that I addressed in the book. And my answer is that it depends. In the case that I address in the book, the employer, it turned out, had a good reason, or plausibly a good reason, for their language-related restriction. Now, first of all, it was worth noting that the employees were bilingual, so they could speak English as well. Second, and the most important part, the other employees in the workforce, in particular an African-American and a Chinese-American employee, complained that they were being that Spanish was being used as a mode of harassment. And the employer, in response to these complaints by other employees, in a context in which the work environment was predominantly Spanish-speaking Latinos and these two workers were somewhat isolated, in response to this concern, instituted the English-only rule. Now, in that context, I'd say two things. One, it's very difficult to describe that, it seems to me, as an instance of atavistic prejudice. In fact, the employer was responding to concerns raised by other employees and developed a rule that that was plausibly responsive to that. Whether the employer should be allowed to have that rule, well, it seems to me that that's a difficult question, but it's not one, again, that's answered by an analysis of race discrimination. If we wanted to say to employers, you may never use language restrictions as a way to deal with, let's say, conflicts among ethnic groups in the workforce, I think that would be that's a different policy discussion that we need to have. I'm not so sure. I'm not convinced that an employer should never be allowed to do that. I mean, I think the case that I cite in the book is an example of one in which there's a decent argument that the employer should be allowed to have their rule.
What about the case of a little different context of having signs in both, let's say, English and Spanish? Should they be prohibited from having Spanish language signs? I bring this up because the same this did arise in Canada, where the prohibition was against English signs.
Right. And in fact, it's also arisen in California in several cities against both Spanish signs, but also, I think, more often signs in Mandarin and Cantonese in communities where they had a large Chinese population that had moved into the area. I don't think that the signs in other languages should be prohibited. Now, there are First Amendment considerations there as well. So, and in fact, I think the First Amendment considerations are paramount. Signs in other languages are a form of expression, and it strikes me that now we're talking about government prohibiting someone from posting a sign on their own property in a particular language, that's a restriction on speech. So you can already begin to see how it raises distinctive issues. But I'll say one more thing about the specific race discriminatory aspects of it. It does seem to me more likely, and I'll simply say more likely, but more likely that these English-only sign laws are motivated by something closer to atavistic prejudice. I mean, it strikes me as more likely that they are, and I'll say this about the whole set of cultural discrimination questions. I do argue that they shouldn't be considered race discrimination per se, but I also think that they may be considered evidence of race discrimination. So the fact that the employer prohibits some practice, if it can be demonstrated that the employer is prohibiting the practice because they want to punish this particular group, because they don't like the particular group, because they want to make it uncomfortable for them and force them out of the workforce, then I think that should be actionable, because at that point they're just discriminating on the basis of race. But that's a different question than that's a question of evidence. It's not a question of the cultural discrimination being race discrimination per se.
We have just about 5 minutes left, and I hope the caller will forgive me. I want to try to include at least one more caller. We have a couple holding. The next in line is in Chicago on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Oh, yes. I have a comment on this. It seems that this whole multiculturalism movement feeds into the globalism. It seems to be an instrument of globalism, and where, you know, global economic interests really benefit from that. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that issue.
Right, that's very interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for that that argument. And I wonder to what extent I think that there's got to be a lot to that argument, and that may well explain why multiculturalism and the idea of cultural differences come to almost eclipse discussions of race and racism, which is another one of my concerns. So because global economic interests, because business interests have an incentive to advance this way of looking at the at questions of group difference, and because it ties in nicely to a globalized economy and what have you, we have a multiculturalist discourse that's eclipsed what I believe are still central questions about race discrimination and racial difference. So, yes, I think you're quite right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Oh, yeah, I've been listening with interest, though I find that a difficult argument to follow. But it sounds, it ultimately sounds to me like you're kind of exhibiting some sort of angst about the rise of the fact that Latinos are now a larger minority than blacks, and I think your argument ultimately can boil down to the question: do you think race is more important issue than cultural differences?
I don't want to say I think it's a more important issue. I do want to say that I think it is an important issue, and that it's an issue that's distinct from issues of cultural differences, and I think requires a distinct analysis and requires distinct policy solutions. So I don't want the problem of racism that I believe continues to be a problem in the United States to be ignored or eclipsed by questions of cultural difference. Now, that's not to say that we don't also have questions of cultural difference and that those also need to be addressed. I do think we have issues of cultural difference and that they do need to be addressed in a variety of ways. I'm not at all convinced that the appropriate way to address them is with anti-discrimination law in the same mode that has developed with race and sex discrimination as the paradigmatic categories. That would be my answer. Now, as far as angst about Latinos becoming the dominant minority group, no, I don't think I have that angst. I think that Latinos suffer in many cases from race discrimination, properly understood, as well as from various types of cultural clashes. So Latinos are a group, you know, and to some extent this is also true of African Americans, but I think the cultural issues probably loom larger in the case of Latinos than the race issues, and the reverse is true in the case of African Americans. But what I do think is that it's important that we look at cultural issues as distinctive. And in some sense, treating them as analogous to racial issues also gives the cultural issues short shrift. It prevents us from having good policy and good discussions about culture because we just immediately jump to the idea that we can analogize them to race questions that we think we already have an answer for. So I think the discussion about cultural differences actually suffered as well as a result of this multiculturalist collapse of the two issues.
I'm going to have to jump in. I'm apologize to the caller. I can't give him a chance to follow up because we are at the end of our time. And for people who are interested in reading in greater depth the ideas of our guest, you can look for the book that we mentioned a couple of times. It's titled Racial Culture, A Critique by our guest Richard T. Ford. He's George Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford, and the book is published by the Princeton University Press. And Professor Ford, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Programs here on AM 580 are made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-designed gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus 580, this show, also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Before we go, just a reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, we'll be talking with William Samuels. He is Director of Humane Education at the ASPCA, and we'll be talking about the importance of humane education. He will be taking part in the annual Humane Education Seminar for the Department of Animal Sciences here at the U of I. He'll be here on the campus next week on March 5th, but we'll be talking with us tomorrow morning on the telephone about a number of things, and including the power of animals in our lives. Also, our number two, we will talk with Richard Lazarus. He's professor of law at Georgetown University, and we will be talking about environmental law. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments, and I hope now you will stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about the Bonus Army. In 1932, thousands of veterans of the First World War marched on Washington to demand immediate payment of a bonus promised to them in 1924 for the time they spent in service. The government said it would pay up, but not until 1945 or upon the death of a veteran. This afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour, we'll hear more about this forgotten episode of American history. Two guests will join us, Paul Dixon and Thomas Allen, authors of The Bonus Army, an American Epic. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 315, that down 1. July, 330 and a quarter, down 3 quarters. March corn, 205 and 3 quarters, unchanged. May, 213 and 3 quarters, unchanged. July, 220 and 3 quarters, unchanged. December